So I'll ask Robert Jan to give his view from Netherlands and the perspective of a policy advisor.
Okay, I'm Robert Jan Shea. I work at Foreign Affairs. I'm a kind of a development expert, but now work in the political department within our ministry. And that gives me a chance to have a bit of a broader perspective sometimes, which I will try to perspire in what I say, but not always. First, I have to compliment Sweden. This is not the first time I come to Stockholm to talk about the internal aid system. I was here, I think, 14 years ago. But I think I should congratulate you that you're doing this kind of internal analysis, because it's important. I read the portfolio analysis of a major donor. I'm not going to say whom, although my notes wrote them down. And they looked at their portfolio in Africa, and only Rwanda performed well. The rest was suboptimal. And there were a lot of reasons for that, they say, but none of them was looking at themselves. But I think it's good that we learn to also to look at our own behavior and what that means for the relationships, like was eloquently explained by Stein-Erik. I think the report poses a number of dilemmas and issues, but it doesn't really resolve them, and I won't resolve them either. And I think, in fact, I just wrote a few extra words. I think the poem which was there is quite important, because it's about reciprocity. It's about giving and receiving in a way that is honest and trustful. And I think we've tried to avoid the word donor-recipient relationship for quite some time, and I'm surprised it pops up every time, even also in my organization in Foreign Affairs. But I think relationships are changing, and my last point will be about changing international relationships and what it might mean for development cooperation. Very briefly, because I only have a few minutes left, I guess. Okay, so I think I want to make three points. One is, I think this idea about mutual learning is crucial, and there is reciprocity in that mutual learning. And I think there's a lot of gaps in the present architecture of development cooperation that hinders that learning. And I think that the most, I will mention two, but I think the most important gap to tackle is, I think, the results gap, in a way that helps us create this reciprocity. And my final point will be on the Busan agenda or the Paris agenda and some of the dangers which Stein-Erik just mentioned, which I do think are quite important, and I will say some things on that. And I have to say that most of the dilemmas that were sketched are the ones we have, despite the fact that we don't have a CEDA. Our development cooperation is well integrated into foreign affairs, so there are much, many, many more opportunities to get things geared well, but it's not that easy, although we try to. I brought one of the annual plans, well, the first page of one of our annual plans. In fact, it's the one of Kampala. But the subtitle of our annual plan, which is they are being released this week internally, where policy objectives and results meet, which is a nice way of saying that there is a place where we meet, but it's perhaps also a bit hiding the fact that it's not easy, as the report explains. What I noticed when I looked at the report, you didn't see the report, but there is this graph in the report where here's the black box of the donor community and a lot of arrows going to the right. There are very few and very small arrows going to the left, which is from the impact back to the policy and the reality. I think that's typical for the kind of behavior we have. We do a lot of things, but the real learning across all the fields is very limited, and I think there is where we have to improve. And I don't know exactly how to do it, but I think the narrow arrows in this graph unconsciously emphasize the fact that we have difficulty making the full loop learning or the double loop learning you need for mutual learning. So how could we improve this learning? I think there are two missing middles I want to briefly mention. One is this results gap, which is say, which we always also have, just these big ambitions, changing the world, making the world a better place, improving human rights. And then they have the results, which are in these kind of annual plans, which are rather, yeah, down to earth. We're going to have a bit of this. In fact, most of the results are the output of activities, and then sometimes a little ambition towards real changes in behavior. But that's reality. You only can change behavior of other people to a certain extent. So there's a big gap between the two. There's this results gap, and we have the accountability gap. And that's because we all operate in a complex arena, and it seems to be that part of the players are looking upwards to, say, our political arena in the West, where parliaments decide on budgets. And in fact, what happens in the Netherlands, if a staff member goes from the center to from The Hague to an embassy, within a few weeks, the loyalty changes from the center to reality, and they start complaining about all the directives they used to send themselves, that they are limited. So these loyalties are very, very deep. They are deep, but they shift rapidly within the system, which is very interesting to see. So, and I think I mentioned that I was here 15 or 14 years ago talking about the work of Eleanor Ostrom. It's difficult to say Swedish names, and she had this very, very well done work on perverse incentives in the aid system, in a way. And she had this eight types of players and all kind of principal agent interactions with all the dilemmas and the perverse incentives of the system. And I think, at least in the Netherlands, we did very little with all these insights. And I really wonder whether Sweden did any better. Did you take this thinking forward, and did you actually change? I would really be interested. But okay, you have these two gaps, and I think we should start, if we want to change things, with the results gap. And I think what we try to bridge this results gap with what we call theories of change. And I think in the past we collaborated with Britain and a bit also with the Nordic countries on, I think then we called the drivers of change studies in the, say, 10 to 15 years ago. We stopped doing that. But I think there's all kinds of attempts to build a gap between the things we do and the things we want to achieve. And we call that a theory of change, where we say this will cause this and this will cause it. In the end, we'll get the result. And I think building this theory of change should be something which you do much more with partners, whether they are, say, what you now call recipients, but there also might be some of your, I don't call them enemies, but people you don't agree with. Because I think when I come to the Busan agenda, I think there's a big issue when it comes to development cooperation. We tend to look for the people we agree with, which is a danger. It's the easy way out. You have to engage also with people, the ones sometimes in power, that go the other way. And you have to deal with them, and you have to try to convince them or work with them, and not just shy away because they are corrupt. So everybody's sometimes a bit corrupt, even in the NGO sector sometimes. So I'm not sure whether we're doing the right thing by shying away from, say, government or difficult partners. So what I would argue is that trying to bridge this results gap together. I've got 2 minutes. Good. I'll manage. I'll go quicker. Okay. Then I'll go to the Busan agenda. I think it is extremely dangerous, especially in present times, to shy away too much from government, and there are a number of reasons. I don't think the Busan agenda says you can leave government aside and civil society can represent country ownership. I don't think that was the intention, so I think it's dangerous to say, well, the Busan agenda allows. I don't think it's a good idea. And I think there is we are moving, for instance, in the Netherlands much more towards the Sahel and other more difficult countries. We're starting to work with fragile countries, and we've got these states with weak institutions. I think it's very, very dangerous to start empowering society without empowering government. And I think this is going to be a new issue in the coming years, where we have to be very careful not only to work with the easy partners, we also have to look at the difficult side. And there's a second issue playing there. I think this is my last minute. And I think we all know that the world has changed, and especially, I think, in the Netherlands, since Valletta, we have found out that the powers have changed and the relationships have changed. We used to go to Africa with a kind of attitude of the the donor, we're here to help you. Things have changed, and we want something from Africa now, and Valletta was a clear example of that. And I think these new relationships where, say, international relationships between, say, foreign affairs and foreign affairs of countries is about common issues or shared problems and not necessarily only about their problems. And I think this puts us in a very different position, and we have to rebalance our relationship with states and governments more and more. So I think there's a number of reasons why within this Busan agenda and this Paris agenda that indeed was declared dead already quite soon after Paris, should be looked at more carefully. We should not shy away from country systems or engage with governments for that matter. So I think my time is up, John. Sorry. Sorry for all the words.
Thank you very much. So more food for thought. And we really get a lot of messages about the importance of relationships in development cooperation. I will now invite Elder Stern to give some comments, and then hopefully we'll have time also for an exchange of views here. Please, Elliot.
Thank you. I'll try and stick to my script, mainly because that will keep me within some time bounds, and I'm aware of how strong the time management is here at this event. Everybody now talks about mutual accountability, as it's already been noted. This has been part of the Paris Declaration. It's emphasized in Busan. It's the underlying principle in many ways of the strategic development goals. And this report that we've heard, by taking a perspective on donor performance, emphasizes that responsibility. It emphasizes that you can't just look at what is happening out there, you have to look at what is happening in here. The report describes itself, I think, reasonably as a model building exercise. I don't think we have a model, but it's outlining a process by which one might move towards a model. And the basic assumption of the report, as Stein-Erik said, is that how aid is provided makes a difference to aid effectiveness. At one moment, that is a statement of the obvious. At another level, it raises extremely difficult theoretical, methodological, and practical problems. So you have to ask yourself questions like, which aspects of aid provision make a difference? How can this be captured, described, or measured within any reasonable timescale and within any likely available resources? How can the behavior and performance of one donor be separated from the behavior and performance of other donors and other development actors? How do processes of planning, implementation, and feedback link with outcomes? And I think the latter question, the linking with outcomes, is for me one of the most problematic. The report begins by answering some of these questions. Aspects of aid provision that are emphasized here are what are called internal factors, things that donors have control over. This includes both the field, embassy-based inputs, and policy, including Ministry of Foreign Affairs and CEDA, although the latter isn't emphasized that much in this report because of time and resource constraints. It also identifies relationships as critical, and clearly all of this is embedded in a wider system. So I think one of the questions about internal focus is where one draws the boundary of the internal, and how far it's practical to extend the internal into a systemic kind of perspective, which most analyses of aid would suggest one should. The report, I find, is quite convincing when it describes the complexity of real-world development and the challenge of combining this with an accountability ethos that many donors, including Sweden, emphasize. But this serves to underline difficulties of description, let alone measurement. And the biggest problem is, as I've already indicated, that of performance. When everything is embedded in multi-stakeholder contexts, establishing links with outcomes are extremely problematic. And in any methodological terms, one is talking about complexity, causal packages, causal pies, ways in which different factors interact with each other, and when interacting with each other have indeterminate effects in contexts that are also different. So in many areas, ranging from medicine to political science, people have been struggling with this problem of causal pies for 20 or 30 years. I think people in international development and evaluation more generally are beginning to address that, but they're mainly addressing it by probably withdrawing from the challenge, by saying it's too complex for us to deal with. And sometimes complexity is used as an alibi. I was given 2 points of orientation, to say something about the usefulness of the approach adopted in the Uganda report, and to say something about aid effectiveness, especially the Paris Declaration principles, such as ownership. I think that developing a model is extremely useful. I also think that this report is appropriately cautious in recognizing that it's just beginning to develop a model. So what we have is an analytic framework that could be developed into a model by a process of what, in methodological terms, we would call abduction. You know, the classic thing is induction and deduction. Well, abduction, by contrast, tries to say, what can we deduce by way of principles, theories, and insights from one case? How can we systematize those assumptions? And how can then we go back into another case using those principles to interrogate the evidence that we see? And that approach is the one that I see underpins what Steiner-Erik has done, and it makes a lot of sense. What is clear, however, that despite some interesting potential findings, principles, I wouldn't quite call them hypotheses, but principles, we don't currently have a model. And then I'm worried about the costs and resources that would be needed to develop one. Now, I think there is a middle point for me, which is if you could systematize this way of thinking into protocols and practices that practitioners, like people in embassies, could use in a self-analytic way, you could use this as an action research framework by which practitioners could themselves build on the foundations that have been laid in this report, develop further ideas for themselves based on their own experience, and successively develop a model through their own practice. That's an alternative to the other possibility, which I think was implied by the presentation, which is one would do further studies and many more studies. And I think it would be an interesting discussion to have with people here in the ministry about what are the resource implications of doing a fully-fledged model-building exercise. The problem of linking with outcomes remains... Oh, I'm doing very well. I have a whole 5 minutes. I'll have to think of something new to say. The methodological problem of linking processes with outcomes, showing that donors make a difference, is still a big issue. And I think the area that would have to be built on to take it in that direction would be, especially if one is thinking of a contribution rather than attribution perspective, is that you'd have to look at some of the causal mechanisms. We need to find ways of linking much more clearly the actions of development actors and the results that both they want and that can be observed. And that focus on mechanisms would be a very useful part of a further stage of work. The second issue that I was supposed to comment on was aid effectiveness and Paris Declaration principles such as ownership. This is pretty difficult, partly because for many people, aid effectiveness has become identified with Paris Declaration principles. So when you ask people what is aid effectiveness, they say they start reeling off the principles as if that is more than what it is, which is a political compromise written in a policy document which was negotiated over late at night and which is then held up as being a flag under which various people can fly. It may be, so we're talking about a normative framework rather than an empirical one. And it may well be that we could achieve high levels of aid effectiveness measured by criteria such as access to services, gender equality, and a policy system responsive to citizens without adhering always to the Paris Declaration principles. So I think the I have this overall skepticism, even though I'm deeply imbued and have been properly educated to talk positively about these things, that I think one has to recognize that as an issue. The second problem for me is that the Uganda report underlines the changing landscape since 2005. The focus on governance, rights, effective public management, and now sitting in a world that is a lot more complicated, with priorities towards economic growth and environmental sustainability and securitization of a lot of aid. Together, these change the emphasis very fundamentally. And the prospect of 77% of Swedish aid in Uganda passing through CSOs by 2018, while only 3% passing through the public sector, is quite striking. So what ownership are we really talking about? Either one has to take the position that Robert took, which is some questioning of the realism of completely abandoning government and the state as a channel, a conduit for development, or one has to have a radically different perspective on what ownership means in this kind of context. So I think I'll stop now to see whether we have at least a few minutes for some kind of interaction. Forgive me for being so fast.
At least I should allow you some space to respond to some of the comments in case you feel up to it. And then I also invite you in the audience to think of issues that you want to bring up.
No, thank you very much for two useful comments. It's always difficult when you've been sitting in with a report for such a long time, you realize clearly the limitations. I just want to mention one thing that Elliot alluded to, is what kind of, if this should be done again, if it should be replicated. I have explained it a bit more in the report itself, but I what I have in mind was more some sort of a formative research process. I don't think you can go in and do, the traditional evaluation is you go in for a week or two, you try to collect as much information as possible, and you go back writing a report. If you are interested in processes between the donor and recipient, and I choose to use those words here, and also between the embassy and CEDA and MFA, you need to follow that over a period of time. I am convinced that to look at those two processes between the embassy and partners and between the embassy and the MFA CEDA would provide useful insights, but it has to be done differently than in this study. And what I had in mind was more of some sort of a long-term formative research or evaluation process. And I agree, of course, this is not a fully developed model. I had a strong view that internal factors are important, and I have tried to develop that a bit further. It's not yet there. It's trying to identify what some of those factors are, but of course much more will have to be done in terms of specifying both the factors and also the methods for analysing them.
Thank you so very much for the very...
Yes.
I'm Oben Daniels. I'm from the Olof Palme International Centre. Very interesting research and a very interesting analysis on the actual research. I'm just interested to find out from the two gentlemen, there is a need to work with governments as much as we have to work with civil society. But how do you work with governments in a country, for instance, like Uganda, or in any other country where there is a clear lack of democracy, there is a repression of human rights in many of these countries, and you have to deal with taxpayers' money, where you have the media, for instance, in Sweden, literally looking at, for instance, Palm International Center, any other funding organization, and how they actually work with the taxpayers' money.
Yeah, perhaps I start with this one. Mm-hmm. I think we went very quickly from budget support back to project support, whereas in the when we went from projects to budget support, we went through what we called PBAs at the time, program-based approaches, which is somewhere in between. We will try to find confined spaces with government where we felt, say, secure enough that there was some way of controlling what happened in a way. So you don't have to go straight away back to budget support. But there are many ways of working with government to make at least sure that the money is spent on, say, on the social services you want to be delivered to people and things like that. That doesn't solve the problem from, say, the human rights issues and democracy issues. But it does allow you to work with systems that in the long run are supposed to deliver these kind of services. Because if we go on the way we're going now, we're undermining the legitimate role of government and also make it less probable that people will feel that their government is their government. So because they don't deliver services, they're not relevant. The only thing they do is go to big international meetings and sign treaties, which they don't live up to. So I think you should always be ambitious. And when we were in the project mode, we found out, okay, this is very limited. We have to be a bit more risk-taking and start and work with these governments we don't know exactly yet. But we have to start building up relationships. And so this is it's also a searching process in a way. So I think there is a middle ground there. But I don't solve all the issues, that's for sure.
Thank you. Yes.
Christoph Hartmann, German Institute for the Evaluation of Development Cooperation. I have a question for Stein-Erik Kruse. So all of you, I think, talked righteous about, to the right, about the Paris Declaration and ownership and importance when it comes to country programs. And the same is true for evaluation, I guess, right? If you do a evaluation of a country program, you need ownership of the party you work with. And I wonder, so how did you ensure ownership? Because I guess it must be in the design phase already, which I'm not sure whether you were part of it. So I would be interested to know how you ensured that and what kind of challenges you find by ensuring ownership of the countries you work with.
You mean ownership of the evaluation?
Yeah, for the evaluation.
Well, I think maybe that's probably an issue for EBA, for us. And and I think the ownership was squarely with us and with the author. I mean, the way we work, we issued a call for proposals and we had a number of persons, researchers and consultants, who submitted proposals to us for doing a country study and I mean, there was no consultation with the countries involved. So in that sense, it was completely donor-centered. And I think that could well be discussed. And I think we could discuss, I mean, the phenomenon on having sort of partner countries evaluating donors, which I know is happening in some countries. So I think there's a lot to say on this issue, in fact. But thank you for the question.
Thank you very much for the report, the presentation, the comments. My name is Leonard Peck. I'm working at the Ministry for Foreign Affairs. Actually, a draft of this report has been circulated. And, of course, the ministry is welcomes any report that can contribute to a more efficient, effective development cooperation. Particularly interesting to look at Sweden as a donor and the relationships. I can mention that this whole, I mean, as you are looking at the strategy steering, new guidelines that actually guide the whole process are right now being looked over. There's, of course, also the aid policy framework, which very much stresses learning, ownership. But when it comes to this particular report, it raises very many very relevant issues. Then, of course, doing it mainly as a desk study is of course, somewhat problematic. We understand you had very limited possibilities to make interviews. Also, we also touched about the question of Uganda as for choice, which in a sense, considering the situation there, is perhaps a bit problematic. And under any circumstances, the conclusions would probably have been quite different if we had chosen another country. Then my main question is actually, we talked about the model building, but as you bring up such a lot of interesting observations here, what is your main message when it comes to then Sweden as a donor?
Great, thank you. Well,
it's addressed to him.
That's the
speaker there.
Maybe one is that what Elliot alluded to about the grandiose rhetoric on ownership on the one hand, and on the other, actually all what a donor is doing actually to undermine that ownership, to look at the gaps between the rhetoric and the realities. And then maybe also another issue which is discussed in the report about the big objectives on the one hand and the realities on the other, and the relatively small resources at the disposal. And maybe it would have been better to be more modest when it comes to the formulation of objectives, and I mean to some sort of get real in terms of what you can expect to achieve with a relatively limited resources. It's not anything is saying that it's not significant and important in its own right, but the objectives are extremely broad. How it should be taken forward, I mentioned briefly about making it into more of some sort of a process approach, which I think is useful, but keeping the reason why I alluded to the poem, because it's talking about the relationship between the person or the agency that provides the support and the receiver. And I think at the individual level, but also at the collective level, that makes a huge difference. How aid is provided, it's obvious, but it's quite difficult to get a handle on. But to try to understand that process better, I think it's important.
Perhaps I want to add one thing. I think if we don't solve this issue, I think support, both in our partner countries and in our own country, for development cooperation will be diminishing even more rapidly than it's doing now. I think with migration, we believe now that we say that we're going to do something about the root causes, and we're remobilizing or reallocating billions towards the root causes agenda with the same ambitions and the same. It is in the short run politically a way out, but it is a very, very dangerous thing to do if we do not solve this results and loyalty and relationship dilemma we have been discussing just now. I just to put a bit of an urgency in what is wrong or going on.
I also think that a more refined view about what we mean by government. I mean, the Paris Declaration trapped everybody in the belief that government meant three guys in the Ministry of Finance who were usually there on loan anyhow from the donor doing the job that the country couldn't do itself to fill in the forms that the donor required. So in most countries, what we mean by government, including in Sweden but also even in Uganda, there is a bureaucracy. There are different sections within that bureaucracy. You may not get on with a minister. That doesn't mean that every single advisor in the ministry concerned is impossible to talk to. There are regional structures of government. There are municipalities. I think a simplistic view about government or not government is part of the trap that the Paris Declaration reinforced, and I think that would be one way forward to question that simplicity.
Thank you. I think we have to end off. I'm sorry. I know there were some of you who wanted also to speak. So thank you very much. Thank you, Sten-Erik. Thank you, Robert. And thank you, Elliot, very much.